"How do you feel?" the newswoman asked the 13-year-old. Sean pouted angrily. "I ain't got nothing to say." He knew not to break the project's code of silence. At around 2 p.m., the medical examiner brought out three black body bags. Sean convinced himself that Fat Mike had not been involved, but the last bag out of the apartment contained a huge round form. Fat Mike was dead at 18 years old, and so was Sean's childhood. He broke down in tears. Sobbing in the hallway, he would not have noticed the skinny, mustached cop pushing past him with the wide-eyed look of a rookie trying to survive in the projects. A few hours earlier, Officer Pete Forselli had pressed his way through a scrum of grieving women to the dirty blue door of Apartment 7C. It was open, but Forselli paused, taking a deep breath before he went in. "Keep your hands in your pockets," barked the detective inside the door. "Don't touch anything." A filthy brown carpet was matted with dirt, blood, and shards of broken crack vials. Someone had plastered over punch holes in the walls without repainting. Stepping gingerly, Forselli followed a trail of blood left by someone who had crawled toward the front door. Forselli passed a bedroom where a porn magazine lay on the floor, displaying the image of a thin black woman naked and spread eagle. Razor blades lay on bedside tables. In the center of the living room was an upturned drawer standing on its end with a pile of red and black topped crack vials and three or four more razor blades. At the end of the hall, two bedrooms. On the right door, someone had daubed "Do Not Disturb" in white paint. In the doorway of the bedroom on the left, he saw one spent 12-gauge shotgun casing, an indication of what lay beyond. In the bedroom, he came upon a horrifying scene, all of it reflected in a wall-sized mirror. The metallic scent of blood, like a bucket of rusty nails that had sat rain-drenched for days, hung in the air. The floor was a giant slick almost half an inch deep. 117 red and black crack vials floated in the blood. The bodies of three men, two completely nude, lay to the right of a bed against a wall sprayed with graffiti. The first victim, a 250-pound black male, lay face down, wearing only a T-shirt, slumped against the exterior wall as if his last moments were spent trying to claw through it. There was a 3-by-3-inch hole in the right rear side of his skull. The blast had been delivered at close range, maybe 3 feet away. Fragments of skull were embedded in the brain. Forselli recognized the lifeless man from the neighborhood and knew him as Fat Mike. Near his head was his pristine red scooter, propped against the wall. The second victim had been a handsome young man with elaborate pomaded hair. He lay naked, his penis exposed. A shotgun round had been fired downward through the man's right shoulder, tearing a path through the man's internal organs. The force of the blast had spun him around, at which point a second round, a slug, had been fired into the right side of his back. A detective said his name was Derek Coleman. The third man, his blue underpants resting on his shoulder, lay under a table where he had crawled to draw his last breath next to the bed. He had been shot in the torso with a shotgun and twice with a .380, once in the neck and once in the thigh. At least 15 detectives filled the room. Forselli felt he was seeing the destruction of this so-called crack epidemic firsthand. It was his first crack-related triple homicide, but it would not be his last. Raised in a tough neighborhood in Yonkers, he'd seen his share of shootings and stabbings, but this, he thought, looked like true evil. Beyond that, he just took it all in, a rookie learning the ropes. A senior officer ordered him to stand outside and hold back the tenants crowding for a look. At around 2 p.m., the corpses were put into body bags. When Fat Mike was lifted by medical examiners, one of them noticed a weight in his sock. He had made a last desperate attempt to hide his jewelry. Inside were three gold rings, two gold chains, a yellow bracelet, and a gold muscle man charm. The crime scene technicians and detectives drove off with a heavy-limbed weariness. Yellow tape was rolled across the door. Outside, a dozen police cars, ambulances, and crime scene vehicles lined up on both sides of the road. Forselli and his partner got back in their car, a Plymouth Grand Fury that marked him as a housing cop, and crawled off around the horseshoe. It was almost 4 p.m, the end of their shift. Forselli, behind the wheel, turned to his partner as he nosed past Cozy Corner, empty of drug dealers for the first time since he'd been working Soundview. Why do people live like this? It could be a bright, joyful day, the sun high in a clear sky, and yet he always felt gloom in Soundview. Some cops in the precinct assumed that the NYCHA deliberately placed all those with criminal records in this particular development. The culture of violence made it different from other projects. People here don't care, Forselli thought, or they are afraid of those who don't care. Forselli's family had been one of only 3 white families in a predominantly black area of South Yonkers comprising Section 8 buildings. Sometimes they ate breakfast cereal for dinner when his father, a construction worker, wasn't able to find work and money was short. At age 7, he had seen an undercover police officer shoot a suspect across the street. As a teenager, he was a scrapper and was often picked on for being the only white kid in the area. He lounged in the parks, drinking beer with his friends, blasting Led Zeppelin on a radio, and tried marijuana a couple of times. He even ran from the cops who had once smashed the radio in frustration when they couldn't catch them. But for as long as he could remember, he'd wanted to be a police officer, taking inspiration from Starsky and Hutch and Kojak. Forselli, patrolman 2307, was barely 20 years old on his first day in uniform in July 1987. He wasn't a naturally imposing presence. When he went for his pre-employment medical, he weighed only 129 pounds. The nurse had to verify that there was no stipulation about being underweight. He had such a narrow waist, just 26 inches, that his duty belt didn't have enough space to accommodate his department-issued pen and pencil, as was required by the NYPD patrol guide. New York City's 180 housing projects were patrolled by 15 public service areas, PSAs. PSA 8 covered around 25 square miles, or roughly half the Bronx. In it were 20 housing projects in 7 police precincts containing thousands of the poorest New Yorkers. The housing cops had a motto, second to none, but the joke among them was that they were, in fact, second to the NYPD, the preeminent law enforcement organization which looked down on them. The third arm was the transit police. He learned in his first days that most cops in the projects were bound by the law of the street, and that this law would determine whether they would be respected. A veteran black cop gave Forselli some advice. "Look, you're a young-looking kid," he said. "You're a white kid, so in the projects they are going to test you. If you cave in, they will fuck with you every time they see you as long as you're in this precinct. So if somebody gets in your face, you need to lay them out." On one of his first patrols, Forselli was dropped off in the middle of the Monroe houses, 3 blocks northeast of Soundview. At around dusk, a local thug named KK took in the rookie cop in his oversized uniform and shiny new leather belt, standing outside 877 Taylor Avenue, a notorious crack spot. KK started spewing obscenities, jeered at him, and threatened to beat him up. Without hesitation, remembering the old cop's words of advice, Forselli pulled his nightstick and swung full force into the man's shins. KK collapsed to the ground, and Forselli slapped on handcuffs. Word got around quickly. Rarely was he tested again in the Monroe projects. Lately, Forselli had been bulking up at the gym 3 to 4 hours every night. Sometimes, after working out, he drove to Lanzetta Pastry on Allerton Avenue and ordered a dozen cannoli and a quart of milk, devouring them in the patrol car between radio calls. He was up to 140 pounds and had grown a mustache to make himself look older. In the summer of 1988, Forselli stood on the roof of a 4-story apartment building on Boynton Avenue, peering through binoculars. Housing cops would periodically work surveillance details from the roofs. Below, he could see the street, swarming with children, and in among them a line of people, 20 or more at a time, waiting to buy heroin. In a sea of crack, this was a holdout area where heroin was still popular and a growing number of addicts had developed HIV/AIDS. Every half hour or so, a hooded figure appeared to do a few transactions before disappearing inside a building. Another line would form, and out he would come. As he looked down at the scurrying figures and the endless supply and demand, he felt disgust. There would be no murders or gunfire if people stopped buying drugs. But here they were, driving the cycle of violence in their own homes. Forselli thought of other cops in the precinct who dismissed the entire Soundview or Bronx River houses as lost areas where the community supported criminals. "As long as they just kill each other off," one cop or another would say, "who cares?" Through the binoculars, Forselli saw two children jabbing at each other as if they were playing tag. Each of them held a needle picked up from a bag on the ground nearby. They risked infection with HIV or hepatitis if their game wasn't stopped. He radioed patrol. On a Friday night, a few days after the rooftop heroin operation, Forselli joined some other cops who liked to unwind at three bars: Riddlers, Peoples, and PCs, referred to by the cops as the Herpes Triangle. On Fridays, PCs, a long dark bar lined with mirrors, was jammed with young Latinas in figure-hugging miniskirts and big hair looking to pick up cops. As Forselli squeezed in at the bar, he caught sight of a light-skinned Hispanic man with a gold crown on his head, surrounded by three bodyguards. Around his neck was a solid gold medallion that must have weighed at least 2 pounds. It was Chicky Rosario, self-styled Emperor of the Bronx. He was the street enforcer for the Bonanno crime family, one of the five families flooding the city with heroin. Rosario controlled the heroin on Boynton and Watson Avenues, an area equidistant between the Soundview, Bronx River, and Bronxdale housing projects. His crew used the Quick Stop Deli in Hunts Point, a few blocks from the Bronx River and across from the abandoned buildings, to sell heroin under the brand name Beef and cocaine under the brand Two Star. He also imported cocaine from either the Virgin Islands or Puerto Rico through Kennedy Airport. It was likely that the needles the children had been playing with were in some way connected with Rosario's trade. And yet here he was, drinking, in a bar full of cops, not only untouchable, but wearing a crown, as if holding court in his own fiefdom, revered as a king while poisoning his own community. Forselli sipped his beer, frustrated at his ineffectiveness at taking down the bad guys. "It's like shoveling shit into the tide," he said to someone. For example, a few months earlier, he'd been tipped off by a cab driver about a swaying drunk brandishing a shotgun near some stores in Castle Hill. When Forselli screeched up in the police car and arrested him, he caught the drunk pushing the gun under a car. It seemed an obvious case. Forselli testified in court, but the man's lawyer pressed Forselli over why he hadn't written down the name of the cab driver who'd given him the tip, something Forselli knew wasn't that important. The lawyer went on to falsely claim that Forselli had planted the shotgun on his client, who was the nearest black man. Forselli lost his temper at the racist insinuation, which cost him the sympathy of the jury. The accused was acquitted, and yet again another guilty man escaped justice. Around November 1988, Forselli was doing a vertical foot patrol in the same building Fat Mike had been killed in. As he moved up and down the claustrophobic and darkened stairwells where dealers had smashed out the lights, he never knew if he might run into a drug deal going down or a guy with a gun and find himself cornered and unprepared in the maze. The other week he'd passed a palsied young woman in a raggedy dress slumped in her own excrement, a needle hanging from her tracked arms as she murmured in the half-light, scratching her arms and body. Forselli had resolved not to slip into the us-versus-them mentality he saw all around him. He knew better. But as he stared at the Emperor across the bar, roaring with laughter at something one of his female companions had said, Forselli felt he was losing the battle.
4. The Ledger of Death.
Profits from crack cocaine pushed up homicides across the Bronx in 1988 and would play a role in at least 38% of all murders in New York City that year. O'Malley worked on one of three five-man teams at Bronx Homicide. For every new murder, O'Malley cracked a new sand-colored steno pad. Soon, the long, thin notebooks covered his desk in a pile several inches deep. It was impossible to spend more than a day or so on each homicide. If there were no significant leads, he'd move to the next. Often the drug dealers would have their revenge faster than O'Malley could solve the first murder. He would identify one perpetrator only to find him murdered a few weeks later. At Bronx Homicide, a detective on the verge of retirement recorded the murders in a ledger of death, a large, frayed, pale blue volume. The detective had begun the ledger on October 9, 1987, and would have to start another on December 13, 1993. In unusually neat handwriting, he wrote the name and address of the victim, the place and date of his demise, and the murder weapon. O'Malley would come in on a Monday morning and ask, "How many bodies did we catch over the weekend?" The 3 days beginning Friday, July 7th, were typical. At 11:30 a.m., Mighty Carvet was found shot dead at 624 East 169th Street in a dispute over crack, the 217th murder victim in the Bronx that year. At 7:30 p.m., Alberto Rodriguez was found stabbed to death opposite 321 East 153rd Street. On Saturday at 12:15 a.m., Jose Garcia was gunned down at the Kentucky Fried Chicken at 321 East Kingsbridge. 2 hours later, over at 1246 Wheeler Avenue in Soundview, Loretta Mason and Diane Clark were stabbed to death in their home. Then at 3 a.m., Pedro Cruz was shot to death at 136th Street and Brook Avenue in the 40th Precinct. At 4 a.m., Manuel Figueroa was murdered with a gun on Boston Road. And in the 40th Precinct, Ismael Quiles was shot at 7:54 p.m. at 730 Brook Avenue. Finally, less than an hour before midnight, Vernon Braithwaite, shot dead in front of 1679 Vice Avenue, became the seventh murder victim in just 24 hours. Five more murders on Sunday brought the weekend total to 12, the last being Theodore Burgess, shot in his home in a dispute over drugs, the 232nd murder victim that year in the Bronx. Of the 430 Bronx murders in 1988, roughly half went unsolved. O'Malley worked 30-hour shifts when the murders backed up, falling asleep at his Underwood typewriter, one letter repeated across the page as he filled out DD-5 forms. A senior cop called Shoefly appeared unannounced at every precinct house and handed out command discipline to napping cops. After his shift, O'Malley climbed into his broken-down Dodge Dart. Sometimes his battery had been stolen, or someone had put a couple of bullets in a door. Other times he'd head home and fall asleep behind the wheel on the Palisades Parkway, jolting back to consciousness to find tree trunks suddenly looming in the windshield as he squealed back into a straight line. To stay awake, he'd slap himself, or drive with his hand out the window in the frigid winter air. When Annie heard him coming, she'd head out the door on her way to work at the hospital. He'd take the baby from her, change his diaper, or give him a bottle. Then it was back in again on the next shift. O'Malley and the other detectives had to set priorities within the first 48 hours after a homicide. Few in the community would help the police, certainly not when drug dealers were killing other drug dealers. So those cases were often passed over for cases the detectives had a chance of solving, or for the killers of children. In February 1988, O'Malley was called to a double homicide in a Morris Heights apartment. Selena Cooper and her 9-year-old daughter, Joy Little, had both been savagely raped and strangled to death, discovered by the girl's aunt on a blood-stained bed, hog-tied next to one another. He found no signs of a robbery, but discovered after speaking with the grandmother that Selena Cooper was a crack addict and mixing with drug dealers. O'Malley normally shielded his wife from the realities of his work, but the murder scene was so horrifying that that night he shared what he had seen with her. The squad suffered from a lack of resources. While the FBI had deep coffers to pay informants, O'Malley and the other officers had to reach into their own pockets if they needed information. Sometimes O'Malley would get a lead from a drug addict or a prostitute, giving the informant $20 from his own pay, with the offer of more if he thought it would help catch the killer. Murder hung in the air like a viral mist. In 1988, the number of killings in New York City would soar by 10.4% over the previous year. Nationally, while young American men of all races killed each other at the rate of 21.9 per 100,000 in 1987, young black males were murdered at almost four times that rate, at 85.6 per 100,000. It was frustrating and thankless work. Distrust between the police and the Bronx communities had broken down into outright animus. 2 years earlier, in 1986, a Bronx drug dealer named Larry Davies, wanted for seven murders, shot six of O'Malley's colleagues from Bronx Homicide as they tried to arrest him at an apartment on Fulton Avenue. He escaped. O'Malley joined the manhunt, but after Davies was captured, he was found not guilty of killing the drug dealers by a Bronx jury. Then in a second trial, a jury acquitted him of the attempted murder of the police officers because he had acted in self-defense. Bronx jury came to mean an impossible conviction. One bitterly cold night, O'Malley followed up at a murder scene on short notice as a favor to a colleague, dressed only in a suit jacket. He canvassed the area, shivering as he handed out tip cards to people in a bid to get witnesses. Back at the precinct, he received a phone call from the family of the victim. They demanded to talk to the detective handling the case. O'Malley introduced himself and briefly ran the names of two suspects past the family. He'd barely started on the second name when the caller blurted, "Instead of interrogating me, why don't you get off your fat ass and get out on the street and do your job?" O'Malley snapped, "Why don't you and your drug-dealing family go fuck yourself?" He slammed down the receiver. 2 hours later, a family arrived at the precinct holding a tape recording of the conversation. "Who is the detective we got on tape telling us to go fuck ourselves?" O'Malley drove home certain he'd be fired. For a week he barely slept. The complaint eventually petered out because the family didn't want to invite police scrutiny. But it was the first time he'd buckled under pressure in the job, and he knew it was a mistake he could never repeat. Years later, he told young cops the story to illustrate how you could never let your guard down. You were always accountable. The housing cops, Forselli among them, were the front line in the growing war between the police and the dealers. One morning in April 1989, showers turned the Bronx streets into slick obsidian, and Forselli, behind the wheel of a GMC 12-seater after dropping cops off on foot patrol, rear-ended a sedan. Back at PSA 8, Forselli reported the accident, and 3 weeks later he was judged to have been driving with excessive speed for the weather conditions, and handed a command discipline along with a 30-day ban on driving. Worse, as punishment, he would have to work foot patrol in the Throgs Neck houses, a mundane sentence of nugatory call-outs offering little of the action of going after dealers on which he thrived. The project lay to the southwest of the Cross Bronx Expressway, 32 acres of three-story buildings on the approach to the Throgs Neck Bridge, which crossed from the Bronx to Queens. Forselli fought his geographical prejudices. If you lived in the projects, some cops argued, then you were an animal and too lazy to work. You depended on welfare and easy money from drugs. Being a cop, it was all about survival and backing up your partner. Softening towards street thugs put everyone at risk. As one cop said, "There are two kinds of people in this world, cops and assholes." Once, Forselli and a partner had been chasing a man who had assaulted a child. Running after him, they shouted into their radios, "Man in blue T-shirt running!" As the man rounded a corner, someone tossed a black T-shirt down to him, and he changed while sprinting. Forselli was discovering that people would do anything to protect their own, even those accused of assaulting children. The police, on the other hand, were seen as venal, corrupt, and untrustworthy. Each day, Forselli had to avoid airmail, chicken bones or D batteries thrown off the roofs at him. In Soundview, a 27-inch TV hurled from the roof had missed him by inches as it exploded on the sidewalk. Yet in the first few days of walking around the Throg's Neck houses, Forselli found something different. Many of the residents held regular jobs, and an 8-hour workday mentality prevailed. Of course, there was some crime. Forselli noticed an informal auto repair business in the shadow of the Cross Bronx Expressway, where enterprising kids disabled visitors' cars and then offered to fix them for a small fee once the owner returned. And there was an illegal barbershop on the first floor of 471 Swinton Avenue. Still, aside from the everyday hustles, tenants were out in the sunshine, something he never saw in Soundview. He was startled when one or two residents even nodded at him on his first days on patrol. As he walked, he might have realized that he was going back to the roots of the Housing Authority Police Department, HAPD, and its community mandate in the 1950s as a dedicated community police force for Robert Moses's newly erected housing projects. There were crucial differences between them and their NYPD brethren. Almost half of the HAPD officers were non-white, mirroring the racial and ethnic makeup of the projects. The nearly all-white NYPD came roaring in to arrest people and left again. They were despised. The housing police, conversely, played ball with kids, stood on the corner when people returned from work, and listened patiently when residents voiced their concerns. The NYPD derided the HAPD as Keystone Cops, but there was no denying their value. But the 1969-70 recession changed the HAPD's relationship with the residents. Factories padlocked their gates, and small stores struggled and closed, while low-income jobs, the lifeblood for the urban poor in the projects, dried up. Welfare payments could not keep up with inflation, and food stamps were worth a third less. Residents turned to the underground economy. Women offered informal daycare and cooked for restaurants or even raised chickens in their apartments. All of this was in breach of NYCHA laws and could result in eviction. Residents did not want the police in their business anymore, creating a rift between them. A few weeks into his foot patrol, Forselli was called to investigate a decomposing body in a third-floor apartment, the type of mundane call all cops dread. The elderly could be dead for weeks before the police arrived. Forselli, covering his mouth and donning latex gloves, forced the door to find a festering female corpse. A sergeant arrived, and Forselli bent to the unenviable task of searching the body. Afterward, he waited alone for the medical examiner, which could take hours. The overpowering stench drove him out into the hallway. Within minutes, he could see a Hispanic man struggling to heave a big reclining chair out of his apartment. Forselli, ever wary, thought that he recognized him as a crack fiend. Eventually, the man, heaving and puffing, pushed the chair all the way up to Forselli. "Officer," he said, "it's not good to stand. You should sit." Awkwardly, Forselli mumbled thanks, saying it wasn't necessary, and carried on standing, only to see the offense his refusal caused. "Okay," he said, sinking into the armchair in the middle of the hallway. The man left, and his mother came out of the apartment with a fresh mug of coffee for Forselli. As the hours ticked by, Forselli sat in the dark hallway. He realized something about his role in these communities. He'd arrived at the Throg's Neck houses with a hostile, confrontational attitude. That prejudice was impossible to maintain here. On foot patrol, he chatted with residents. One or two confided to him that they were saving to get out or go to college. They paid the consequences when the drug dealers moved in. Forselli began to understand that most were good, honest folks who'd been dealt a rough hand and were capable of kindness and generosity. His cynicism seemed to melt away as he sat outside this apartment. Residents began to seek him out. Even a man who worked as a black market mechanic in the project car lot against NYCHA rules asked Forselli to talk to his 16-year-old boys who were getting into trouble on the streets. Forselli went to their apartment and tried to show them that a better life could be had without drugs and crime. The boys at least listened to what Forselli had to say. Still, the code of the street ruled. Around June, Forselli got into a confrontation with a drug dealer who cruised around every day in a black Nissan Maxima. Forselli had seen this before. A new drug dealer arrived, opening a portal to heavier crews who were able to deliver kilos rather than ounces, but consequently they also brought more substantial firepower, along with a willingness to use it. Slowly, the cycle of violence would begin as the drug dealer attempted to ruthlessly eliminate rival dealers. Now, as the sun brought the residents out to soak up the rays, this new drug dealer turned up again outside an apartment that doubled as a crack house for a notorious local dealer called Frederick. People gathered, and Forselli had to act. To back down in front of everyone could cost him his reputation, making his job impossible, if not dangerous. He'd been called before to assist cops who'd been mugged and had their guns and badges stolen. After that happened, it was too dangerous for them to walk the projects, so they spent their days in the basement records room. Forselli sprang into action, slapping the dealer across the face before spinning him around and handcuffing him, arresting him for trespassing and disorderly conduct. As Forselli led him away, a loud cheer and a smattering of applause arose from the residents. A short while later, Forselli chased down a man who fired 6 shots right outside the precinct, sprinting 3 blocks to tackle him to the pavement. After that, kids in the project joked he was the fastest white guy they'd ever seen. The residents nicknamed him Pac-Man, after the 1988 movie Colors, in which Sean Penn plays a Los Angeles cop fighting gang violence. A street name indicated that he had won respect. A few mothers joked that they wanted the 20-year-old Pac-Man to marry their daughters. A father invited Forselli to his 16-year-old daughter's birthday party. Forselli politely demurred. Empowered by some of his successes, Forselli wanted more than ever to liberate the residents of Throg's Neck from the drug dealers. An anti-crime unit had been tasked with shutting down Frederick's crack house, but most of the cops seemed more interested in claiming overtime on arrests than in setting up long-term surveillance during regular hours. Just one arrest could generate at least 24 hours of overtime in the court system, and there was always the problem of the dealer's immunity from eviction. Forselli's partner, Pat Kelly, had been mentoring him in the language of the street. He'd taught Forselli how felons recently released from prison shone with health after 3 square meals and a weightlifting regimen, while those on the street were often skinny from fast food and drugs, alcohol, and cigarettes. Wearing plain clothes, they began watching Frederick's apartment. After 10 days, they spotted a random buyer leaving with crack in his hand and swooped in. Back at PSA 8, they told the man he might be able to reach a deal with the DA if he cooperated. Based on his testimony, Forselli got a search warrant to hit the apartment, arresting Frederick. Forselli continued to discover ways in which the system worked against him and the tenants, protecting drug dealers who held the community in fear. He tried to get Frederick evicted, but his NYCHA hearing resulted only in probation. The gangs seemed an impossible cancer to eradicate. While Forselli evolved as a street cop, over at Bronx Homicide, O'Malley's crime-fighting skills grew. He was learning how to detect a lie, build confidence, and bluff when he had to. Slowly, he was solving murders. Toward the end of August 1989, an armored car was robbed of $500,000 in the South Bronx. One of the drivers was shot and killed on his first day of work. O'Malley partnered with a local precinct detective, Stanley Schiffman, who had earned fame for once getting a killer to confess by saying that his victim had a miniature camera in his eye and had recorded the image of his murderer just before he died. Despite the confession, a Bronx jury acquitted him. O'Malley and Schiffman interviewed the surviving driver, 26-year-old Wycliffe Warner, in The Box, the interview room at the 47th Precinct. Warner gave an emotional blow-by-blow account, saying that a car had rammed the back of the truck and his partner, Billy Hackworth, had opened the door and been shot. Parts of the story weren't adding up. For one, armored car drivers were instructed never to open the doors. "This guy's full of shit," said O'Malley outside the interview room. "He's hinky about something." Schiffman agreed. They could angrily confront him over his lies, but O'Malley had seen detectives explode doing this, with the accused clamming up and asking for a lawyer. And the brass was pressuring them to solve quickly. "We'll play along with it for now," said O'Malley after securing permission from his lieutenant for a gentler approach. They returned to the interview room. "It's terrible about your partner," said Schiffman empathetically. After a few hours, they let him go home. Picking him up in the morning, they drove to Hunts Point to look at the murder scene outside the Marine Midland Savings Bank, and then stopped for lunch. They saw how Warner couldn't keep his story straight, and his defensive posture was a giveaway. But as they ate pizza together, chatting about the Bronx, their families, the bond deepened. Warner warmed to the detectives. "Help us figure this out," appealed O'Malley, knowing Warner was shading the truth, yet still hoping to reason with him. After a couple of days, O'Malley and Schiffman were no nearer to a confession, so they came up with a ruse. "Look, they're busting our balls downtown about this," O'Malley told Warner. "They want you to take a polygraph, so let's just get it out of the way. Nothing to be alarmed about." In truth, any lie detector results were not admissible under state law. Warner took the test and failed miserably. Commiserating with Warner, they took him back to the 47th Precinct, where O'Malley looked him in the eye, appealing to his decency. Warner regarded the detectives and crumbled. He admitted that he had set his partner up and shot him in the head while an accomplice, Cuthbert Joseph, bagged the money. A weight seemed to lift off his shoulders as he spoke. O'Malley arrested Joseph, who told the detectives that he had stashed the money in an apartment on Vice Avenue. From a hallway closet, O'Malley and Schiffman extracted a duffel bag containing more money than they had ever seen. It took all night to count it. $498,940. The following day showed O'Malley and Schiffman leading the suspects on a perp walk in front of TV cameras. Though the case added to O'Malley's reputation, these were small successes, tiny victories in a city where murders were getting out of control when they peaked in 1990 at 2,262. The greatest number of these per capita, 54 per 100,000, were in the Bronx. Next came Manhattan with 33.8, Brooklyn with 33.3, Queens with 16, and Staten Island with 7.7. Detectives competed with one another over which precinct would reach 100 homicide cases first. Beyond the Bronx, the 34th precinct in Washington Heights competed with the 75th in Brooklyn with its 8 public housing complexes. It became an NYPD tradition among homicide squads for detectives to pay all funeral expenses for the 100th murder victim every year. In 1990, a 15-year-old black male in Harlem had a 37% chance of reaching the age of 65. New York City was divided into areas where violence was commonplace and where inhabitants were largely shielded. If you lived on the Upper West Side, you were safe until you went north and crossed 86th Street, where your chance of being the victim of a major crime doubled. Those living in the 19th Precinct, the Upper East Side, lived in one of the safest in the city. But if you lived in the 32nd Precinct, you were 31 times more likely to be murdered than someone living in Bayside, Queens. In short, the odds that an urban black male in America would be murdered with a gun were greater than they had been that a U.S. soldier would be killed in Vietnam. O'Malley and other Bronx cops like Forselli despaired at the stark difference between how the city handled the Bronx's soaring black homicide rate and how it handled the murder or rape of wealthy white residents or tourists in Manhattan. Brian Watkins was a 22-year-old high school tennis star from Idaho attending the U.S. Open with his family in New York. He was fatally stabbed in the subway station at 53rd and 7th Avenue while protecting his father from a Queens gang who'd slashed his pants to get at his wallet. The city went into overdrive. A scrum of reporters besieged the NYPD demanding to know the identity of the culprits. Within 2 hours of the murder, at around 10 o'clock on a Sunday night, Manhattan cops were rounding up suspects. By Tuesday, the family was being led into the precinct at 42nd Street, jostling with TV cameras and photographers to view 54 men for 9 lineups. 8 teenagers from Queens were charged as a swarm of well-funded Manhattan detectives, some looking for kudos for solving the case, gave statements on the arrests to the media. While some of the Manhattan detectives wore form-fitting suits, pompadours, and pinky rings, in the Bronx, O'Malley and other detectives dressed in polo shirts and jeans because they knew they'd never be interviewed about their cases. Few people were interested in young black kids caught in a steady and unremitting cavalcade of death. Meanwhile, Forselli had returned to car patrol duty in Soundview. When he asked at the precinct what perpetrators he should be looking out for, he was told one name, Peter Rolock. 5. The Kids from Cozy Corner. As Pete Rolock saw it, he was born to be a mafia godfather. His father enjoyed prestige in the underworld after having made a name for himself working with the heroin baron Nicky Barnes in the 1970s. Pete had gangster bona fides, and he wore them with honor. As Pete and Pipe walked up to Cozy Corner, the old-time gangsters offered a reverent, "Hey, what up, little Petey?" Pete saw himself as the scion of an American dynasty. He moved like an heir apparent and, perhaps unsurprisingly, he was infatuated with living up to his father's reputation. "My pop's in Nicky Barnes, yo," Pete once told Pipe proudly. "The only niggas to be with the 5 families." He liked to show off a well-thumbed newspaper article that linked the Lucchese family and Nicky Barnes with his dad. Barnes was said to have a heroin business worth $72 million a year. Only the Italians, his business partners, had the connections to bring product from the poppy fields of Asia and the cash to pay $220,000 a kilo, while using Barnes's organization to distribute through inner-city neighborhoods. "My pops could go anywhere in the city, black neighborhoods and Italian neighborhoods," he bragged. Leonard Petey Rolock, a.k.a. the Boxer, was a lower-level distributor busted in a DEA sting after selling heroin to an undercover agent in the Bronx in November 1976. Barnes got life without parole, and Leonard Rolock got 15 years. On his release, Rolock and James Jackson, Barnes's nephew, formed the Jackson Organization, running their operation out of a Harlem hotel on 116th Street while procuring high-grade heroin through a connection to Gambino boss John Gotti. Barnes resented the success of his erstwhile business partners and eventually cooperated and helped indict 44 traffickers. In a final sweep, Jackson and Rolock were arrested in February 1987. Jackson, like Barnes, cooperated and by September turned on Pete's father. Leonard Rolock would be sentenced in the Southern District of New York to 50 years for racketeering in 1992. Because he refused to flip, Rolock commanded respect in prison as a strong man, true to his gangster creed. "Nicky Barnes snitched," Pete said when he heard of his father's indictment in the summer of 1988. "Motherfucker is putting my pops away." Pete and Pipe came to a halt on Cozy Corner and looked up at the giant 30-by-15-foot mural on the wall next to the supermarket. It had been 6 months since the slaying of Fat Mike and his crew and the triple murder that had rocked Soundview, establishing a new benchmark for violence. The mural said, in large blue letters, "Kids from Cozy Corner." To the left of the inscription was a man with a snarling face, twisted with venom, as he blazed with a flame-spewing semi-automatic pistol. The O in Cozy was an exploding orange bullet. To the left was an ersatz biblical scroll. On it, in a bluish-black stylized copperplate, R.I.P. was written above 3 names, Baldy, Derek, and Mike. There were still vague traces of a makeshift shrine, a cardboard box cut open front and top containing pictures of Fat Mike along with candles, prayers, and mementos in his honor. At school, relatives of the murdered men sobbed in class. Pipe saw the community pull together, a tight-knit family ruptured by grief. The killing, a triple homicide of ordinary and well-liked young men by their peers, demonstrated to everyone in Soundview how far so-called friends in the drug game were willing to go to protect their own profits. On the street, the code was changing. Hustlers were saying that they would have to kill to make a name and to protect themselves. Families, it was rumored, would now be targeted to get revenge. There were no boundaries anymore. Sometime in the past few weeks, they had run into a neighborhood hustler they knew called Stymie. He had survived the triple homicide in January. He gave little away, but the story eventually emerged. Some of the men were sniffing cocaine as they bagged up crack. Around 3:30 a.m., they heard a knock on the door. When they opened it, they saw Kirk Johnson, whom they'd all known since childhood. Kirk blocked the door, raised a sawed-off shotgun, and called to four other men, all armed, down the hall. The assailants had been ordered not to sell crack on Cozy Corner by the crew that controlled the southern side of the projects, who took orders from a man named Lester. Johnson and the other four worked for E.T. Larry, the other dominant dealer in the area, who controlled the crack trade in the Sack Warenhouses with his green-topped vials, but was looking to expand into Soundview. He'd earned the nickname because some of the kids in the neighborhood thought his long neck and large features made him resemble E.T. in the Spielberg movie. The men marched Fat Mike and the others into the back bedroom, where they were ordered to strip before their jewelry was taken. Fat Mike, perched on the end of the bed next to Stymie, refused to remove his T-shirt. Waverly, known as Baldy in the neighborhood, a low-key street hustler, begged for his life, pleading that his young daughter had just been born. "Why are you doing this?" he implored. "It's not necessary." Hull, the owner of the apartment, also begged for his life. "I don't have anything to do with this. Why don't you let me go?" One of the gunmen, Nelson Burgos, cut them off. "Fuck, they all going to die tonight," he said. Kicking one of them in the face, he raised a .380 and shot at Stymie, who lifted his right arm in defense. The bullet dug into his elbow. Burgos shot him in the chest. The third time, Burgos sent a bullet crashing through Stymie's groin, ripping off one of his testicles. Stymie, still alive, squinted as the killing unfolded. Johnson stood on the bed with a 12-gauge shotgun and blasted Fat Mike in the side of the head point-blank. Stymie saw running feet leaving the room. Hull, who also survived, got up, fell down again, and managed to crawl down the hall before collapsing. Stymie staggered to the living room to call 911. Two officers arrived, saw the carnage and the men clinging to life, and backed out. They shouted from the hallway, asking the wounded if everyone had left, while taking cover on either side of the front door as they waited for backup. An ambulance arrived, and Stymie was taken to the hospital. From his bedside he told the police everything he knew. Kirk Johnson was quickly identified as the shooter. He bolted to Seattle, and his family fled the projects. He and his men made just $300 for the murders. NYPD detectives finally caught up with Johnson, and under enormous pressure from the community, Stymie eventually testified against him. It was an unprecedented move, the community urging a gangster to snitch. Pete and Pipe looked at the mural and understood its poignancy. Everyone loved Fat Mike, but beyond that, the murders made it clear that seemingly ordinary kids like Kirk Johnson could become treacherous mortal enemies overnight. Up to this point, the allure of the gangster life, romanticized in the pictures of mafiosos on the walls in Pete's bedroom, had been a game, mostly posturing. Even Pipe's own shooting had been a warning rather than an attempt to kill. But the triple killing gave some indication that they were unprepared for the violence. Suddenly, things had gotten serious. D-Spot, for example, had a gun that Pipe had seen, but he'd never had to use it. It was for show. Now people started carrying guns intending to use them. No one wanted to end up like Fat Mike. Indeed, Pipe stood before the mural with a fully loaded Tech-9 semi-automatic pistol in his book bag. Inscribed with thick silver writing on the bag was the name of its owner, Peter Rolock. P. Pete had enlisted Pipe as his gun-bearer. Most days, Pipe slipped into the back of Pete's classes with him at Stevenson High School, baseball hat pulled low over his eyes, 3 years too young for 10th grade, always ready to hand the gun over if Pete needed it. Recently, outside the front gates of Stevenson as they were leaving school, Pipe had spotted the two kids he had shot. One had a plaster cast on his arm. Privately, he was relieved he hadn't killed them, and even more so that he hadn't been recognized as the shooter. Pete was talking about taking the crack business to another level. He was still a small-time supplier and didn't hustle, considering it beneath him, unlike Pipe, who sold on the corner. Pete had been buying from the lynch mob, but he said he had a new drug connection in Manhattan who could give him the break he needed with significantly more weight, slang for multiple kilos. His father had supplied heroin, but Pete would dominate the crack trade. He had heard users describe that first velvet high as a ride on a high-speed elevator where you soared to the top. The next ride was never quite as high, and so users would always be seeking to get back to that original feeling. It was a limitless and clamoring market. Hustlers couldn't re-up fast enough in Washington Heights, the epicenter of New York's rapidly growing Dominican community. The steeply wooded enclave at the north end of Manhattan had become a terminus for drug dealers all over the city. While the cocaine came from Colombia, the Dominicans had the street-level contacts to distribute the drug in poor neighborhoods. Street lore has it that a Dominican, Santiago Luis Polanco Rodriguez, or Yeyo, as he was known, was the marketing genius who brought the drug wholesale to New Yorkers. The king of crack forged links with African-American and Hispanic communities in poor neighborhoods from the seat of his gray Mercedes convertible. Pete had several connections in Washington Heights and began distributing to hustlers in Soundview in larger quantities. As Pete's drug operation flourished, he enlisted a growing crew of resolute kids from the Soundview projects, like Pipe, willing to commit violence in his name. The murder of Fat Mike had changed the entire drug landscape in Soundview. E.T. Larry had quickly filled the vacuum his gunman Johnson had left by taking out Lester's crew. Lester had vanished. Green crack vials started to turn up on Cozy Corner, indicating E.T. Larry was taking over. But when E.T. Larry heard that Stymie was talking to the police, he, too, left town in a hurry. All this offered an opportunity for Pete, Pipe, and the crew to expand and to take over Soundview. They formed an easy alliance with D-Spot and the lynch mob. Pete and Pipe knew that they would have to kill E.T. Larry and his men if they returned. Pipe told himself that he couldn't be scared of dying or his weakness would be his undoing. In fact, he was afraid, though he told no one. To Pete and everyone else, he appeared impassive. Pete talked all the time about the money they would make. "I want to be just like my pops," he said, "just without the jail time bit." In the fall of 1988, 12-year-old Pipe stood at 551 Randall Avenue on the corner of Rosedale, his regular hustle spot overlooking Cozy Corner. He kept the .22 Pete had given him either in a broken mailbox inside the lobby or under the steps near a back entrance. Standing on the block was an art form. It was either the center of the universe or the most boring place on earth. Competition was intense at Cozy Corner, and Pipe had seen soft hustlers get chased off the block at gunpoint. "Niggas is trying to eat out here, man," the attacker would say, snatching the drugs and chasing the weaker one off into the night. Sometimes one or two cops came and robbed the dealers of their money or planted drugs on them. At 11 p.m., just when their tour was over, some of the cops who wanted extra overtime raced up to Cozy Corner in their car to snatch the slowest runner, leading to a night of paperwork and time and a half. The dealers learned to use a decoy to lead the cops on a chase before giving up and submitting to a search, which of course revealed no drugs or weapons. A figure came up. "Give me two, little man." Pipe took the dirty bills and folded them into a hard-packed rosette of money in his back pocket before he dropped the crack vials into a grasping hand. Half an hour later, as Pipe slouched on the corner, a shoeless woman approached him, her filthy underpants and smudged bra visible through a torn dress. Her eyes looked ready to pop out of their sockets. Her mouth, caked in a white substance, showed loose teeth and blackened gums. When she came close to him, Pipe recognized her as Janet, one of the sharpest older women in the neighborhood and an aunt of one of Pipe's friends. "Yo, Janet, that you?" asked Pipe in disbelief. Before becoming a crack addict, she wore colorful flowing dresses, exuded a powerful femininity, and cared for her two children, the first only a couple of years younger than Pipe. "You know what it's like when you got that monkey on your back," she said. Janet pleaded with Pipe for crack on credit. Pipe gave her a couple of dime bottles, 2 $10 servings. The drug was moving closer to home. Pipe's mother had switched from heroin to crack for the occasional binge. The drug caused her to launch into paranoid and deranged tirades. She claimed that her children were talking about her and once tried to choke one of Pipe's sisters. As her addiction to crack progressed, she lost her grip on motherhood and her ability to protect her children. Once, when Pipe came back late from a trip to the store, she swung clumsily at him with a hammer, shouting that he was out on the block talking about her. Pipe ran away, but just as darkness came, with nowhere else to go, crept back into the building and made his way up to the dark, musty stairwell, to the top where the door led to the roof. The 11-year-old pulled his arms inside his T-shirt and attempted to sleep, shivering on the cold and filthy concrete, praying he wouldn't be harmed in the night by addicts, rival dealers, or a nervous cop with his finger on the trigger during a vertical patrol. Before crack, his mother would have punished him for staying out at night, and certainly for doing something as dangerous as sleeping in the stairwells. At dawn, his brothers and sisters woke him with the news that his mother was sober and it was safe to return. "Mama say come back in the house." In the doorway, she apologized profusely, gravely upset at what she had done. Pipe knew that his mother still loved him, and he never stopped loving her. By now, he always knew that when the drugs wore off, she'd be her old self again. He learned to look past the moment and to wait patiently for her to return. What could he do? He had to feed the family. He vowed he'd never take crack himself, but the accumulation of money became the ultimate goal, no matter the cost. When he'd turned 12, his mother had organized a surprise for him. "I seen the way you run after those dirty little-ass girls," she said. With her son in the full flush of puberty, and knowing that kids in the projects had sex early, she was worried about the new plague sweeping the beleaguered Bronx. First they'd been besieged by heroin and fire, then crack and homicide. Now it was HIV/AIDS. So his mother set the virginal pipe up with his first meaningful sexual encounter, focusing on safety. A 19-year-old female friend of the family who owed Miss Annette a favor agreed to show Pipe how lovemaking worked. While his mother sat next door in her room and the rest of his siblings were outside playing, the young woman undressed in Pipe's bedroom. She ordered Pipe to undo his pants and drop them to the floor. Then she lay back on his bunk bed and ordered him to start with oral sex. The 12-year-old balked shortly after he began. "I ain't putting my face down there," he protested loudly. His mother burst into the room. "No, you ain't got to show him all that," she said. "Show him everything else." "See?" Pipe pouted. "My mom say I ain't got to do that." Miss Annette left the room, and his initiation resumed. Pipe stopped abruptly when he felt a powerful urge to urinate. The young woman said that the sensation was normal. Shortly thereafter, he took one more step toward manhood. Out on the street, the heady promiscuity of crack offered too many chances for an adolescent to resist. Pipe and the other teenage boys had long lusted after an unattainable 20-year-old, a young woman in the projects who wore tight skirts, her hair always perfectly done. She had looked at them disdainfully until she started buying crack. Now, when she ran out of money, she offered sexual favors to teenage hustlers. Pipe took her to the roof they called Pebble Beach, and he and another dealer had sex with her. Sometimes she removed her teeth for blowjobs. By the spring of 1989, Pipe needed more product. Pete's promised connection in Washington Heights had come through, and he was supplying as many hustlers as he could. He gave Pipe all the cocaine he had, but Pipe was selling out all the time. When he complained to Crackhead Bimo, the old man